Hi, I'm Ken.
And I'm Dee.
And this is Antiques Freaks.
Your podcast. For you.
About antiques. This week, we will be discussing a book circa 2014.
Now that's not old at all, Ken.
No, but it's about old shit.
2014, really? Is that old?
Yeah.
Oh, shit.
Time, man. It marches on. We're going to be talking about The Goldfinch by Donna Tartt.
Ah, The Gold by good old Donna Tartt. Writer of such books as... Ken? I forgot the titles of all her books.
She's only written three!
Yes.
Her first book, The Secret History, came out in 1992.
Easily one of my favorites.
Her second book, The Little Friend, came out in 2002, my mistake.
Easily one of the books I've read.
And her most recent book, The Goldfinch, came out in 2014.
An emotional firestorm.
2014.
Yes, I'd say The Little Friend is easily one of the books I've read in years.
Why the fuck are we talking about this book on Antiques Podcast?
Says everyone.
Let's take a look at the blurb. Theo Decker, a 13-year-old New Yorker, miraculously survives an accident that kills his mother. Abandoned by his father, Theo is taken in by a wealthy Park Avenue family. He is bewildered by his strange new home, and, tormented by his longing for his mother, clings to the one thing that reminds him of her. A small, mysteriously captivating painting that has come into his possession. As an adult, Theo moves easily between the antique store where he works, the drawing rooms of the rich, and the underworld of art. He is alienated, unmoored, and in love, and drawn inexorably by the power of that painting into a narrowing, dangerous circle.
I have literally never read the blurb before.
Dee, does that even remotely describe the book you read?
Not even fucking close. That's a different book.
A different factual inaccuracy in every sentence.
Like, hi, I'm the guy who wrote the blurb. I didn't fucking read it. Like, listen, I'm busy. People don't hire me to read books. They hire me to write blurbs. Yeah, listen here, I didn't read it. Yeah, okay? It's about a guy and he does some stuff. There, goodbye.
Now, you may have noticed in one of the many sentences in that blurb, the phrase, the antique store where he works. And that is the connection we will be hyperfixating on today.
Yeah, that will be what we rotate around.
The sun around which we orbit.
It will be the theme of antiques. You're welcome.
Dee, how would you describe the book?
Well, I believe earlier when I was mentioning that this book made me so depressed I couldn't continue reading it for about 4 months. I would sum up the book by saying, like, hey, you remember grief? Get ready to! It's a book about, like, grief, the power of trauma, and I would call it definitely, like, a Bildungsroman, a coming-of-age story. A coming-of-age story that is told almost entirely through the lens of an intensely broken person.
With antiques.
Whose fixation is, and some would argue salvation, I guess this is a warning, there will be spoilers.
Yeah.
Is antiques. Although, like, maybe that's painting the strokes too broad. But yeah, basically.
I'm gonna try and keep the first half of this episode spoiler free, but like, if this novel contains antiques is too much of a spoiler for you, go read the book. We'll wait.
Yeah. Like, I also feel a little ridiculous, because, like, if there is a change in tone in the novel, is also a spoiler for you, like, go read it.
Go read all 800 pages, and then come back.
Yeah, that'll be your homework. See me. See me after class.
So, I would describe this book as an extended heist.
That, you know what, I actually left out that very important part.
A heist movie where it focuses on all of the details that aren't super fun, necessarily.
Yeah.
Like, it focuses on, like, the consequences of a heist, kind of in the same way that The Secret History focused on the consequences of a murder mystery.
Yeah, I think you could combine it and be like, it is a coming-of-age story if your entire coming-of-age centered around something really bad you had done that was a heist.
So, antiques.
Sure are.
They appear in this book.
Sure do.
Because the young man, Theo, who It happens in the first chapter. I'm just going to mention it. He's in an art museum with his mom, looking at the early Dutch painting, The Goldfinch. And there's a terrorist attack. The museum is blown up. His mother dies. He is in a different room and is largely unscathed, encounters a dying old man who is having some flashbacks and pleads with Theo to rescue the Goldfinch painting so it's not sacked in the chaos of the aftermath of the explosion. And he then just kind of keeps this painting because he's 13 years old and he doesn't know what the fuck else to do.
Well, yeah.
And it kind of snowballs from there.
Just like, imagine the worst trauma of your life. I sometimes forget to turn in my library books on time if I had a rough week. So I get it.
Yeah, I can get my mom died in a terrorist attack. I forgot to return this painting.
Yeah.
And also I'm 13 and I don't know how to do it and I'm terrified of getting turned over to social services or jail.
Yeah.
So like, I get it.
Yeah.
But the elderly man who died in front of him essentially also gives him a ring and says to return it to a particular antique store. And so Theo does, and thus he meets Hobie, the best character in fiction.
Yeah, the best character in the book, and any book ever.
The platonic ideal of an antique dealer.
Definitely. Yeah, absolutely. And also, my dad.
My new dad. But yeah, because Hobie is an antique dealer, a lot of the action takes place in and around said antique store, and that antique store becomes where Theo is trained up into a vocation.
Yeah.
With a brief detour to Las Vegas.
For reasons. I guess that we had to introduce other characters there, so.
Yeah. Donatart's prose is, like, lyrical and immersive and vivid in general. Her description of antiques in this book in particular, I think, is the best example of her ability to immerse the reader in a beautiful environment. The power of prose.
I would second that, yeah. I at no point ever had the feeling that she didn't know what she was talking about when it comes to what it felt like.
How did you, D, as an antiques person, feel about the portrayal of the antiques industry in this book?
The industry?
Yes.
Not the antiques themselves.
Both. Either or.
I think, okay, overall, fucking excellent. Like, as a broad stroke, I'm going to actually go ahead and say that, like, either Donna Tartt has been an antiques enthusiast for some time, or very, very much immersed herself in the world of it to be able to get the feel of what it is like to be one of those people. That being said, Donna Tartt seems, there are strata of being in, of antiques, like, industry, and Donna Tartt has narrowed it to one very enviable and incredibly, like, high-profile strata.
Which is very rare furniture pieces.
It's the like, if you could split it almost cleanly in half between Israel Sack and his cohorts. And people like you and me.
Who have podcasts?
Well, like, you know, jacks of all trades, people who don't necessarily have highly specific areas of research, people who do not have the money to invest in high-end pieces at all, because it is absolutely, like, the higher up you go, the more it straight up is just a millionaire's game. My major problem with it, and it's not really a problem, this is, like, strictly personal, it perpetuates the very romantic notion that when you're into antiques, it's all like this. When, like most things, it's the tip of an iceberg, the iceberg mostly being made up of working Joes who really like old stuff at, say, a giant flea market.
Yeah, it's very much what we all wish working in antiques was like.
It's the best of the best, it's the highest of the high.
But it really did not speak to any of my day-to-day experience as an employee in an antique store.
Not a fucking one.
There needed to be more Connecticut's and white pants.
They actually did.
They did, no, I
don't want to give away too much because I don't know how you want to structure this, but like, yeah. When it comes to rooking, they were accurate. So, I mean, you know, it's great for that. Like, I understand why it's structured that way. It had to be that way for the narrative and the character. And I think it's actually an excellent representation for someone who's never actually lived it, but I do know the people who have. You know, it's remarkably petty and busy and high stakes and anxiety-inducing. And did I mention petty? Oh my god, those people are so fucking petty.
Are you talking about the customers or the antiques industry as a whole?
All of it.
We just lost all our listeners.
I know. I mean mostly once you get to the high-end stuff.
All those petty, petty fucks who listen to this podcast.
Once you stop needing to survive with it, you become intensely petty.
Once you no longer have any life or death skin in the game.
Yeah. Once it's all gravy, the people get very petty.
And none of them will appear on this podcast.
They will never. Because I made fun of Israel Sack like a minute ago, so like.
Oh no, I actually.
The whole episode dedicated to slagging the Kino twins. Like, not making any friends in the industry, I think.
Listen, they started it.
It was three course lines.
Maybe it was three course
lines. Maybe it was three.
So I scoured the internet looking for antiques people having opinions on this book. I did not find many.
I was really surprised talking to people I know that they A, had read the book, and B, the ones who had way more to say about the emotional beats of the story than the antiques.
Interesting.
Yeah, I was pretty surprised because usually it's a small interest and usually people get pretty excited when literally anyone cares about it. I wish I could answer that for you. I pretty much only read it because of it being centrally tied into the idea of antiques. So yeah, I don't know. It doesn't seem like there's as much of a buzz as like I would have hoped for.
I did find two antiques persons willing to put their opinion on the book on the internet.
Okay.
First, we have Tim Martin, president of SJ Shrubsole.
Okay.
Does that name mean anything
to you? It really doesn't. Okay.
They are apparently a very high-profile, highfalutin antiques business.
Okay.
We will trust that that is true and speak on.
I'm sure they are.
Quote, "For all I know, her descriptions of restorations are accurate. But her descriptions of the trade, her understanding of the significance of provenance, her notions of imposters and confidence men taking chocolates to little old ladies till they sell them the family highboy, of six-figure Sheraton sofas, and, yes, of collectors as invariably knowledgeable connoisseurs, are so inaccurate that, combined with many other problems, only some of which I've mentioned, they shatter any illusion of reality and render the book a prosy slapdash of information and suspense."
Eat my every pair of shorts I own, buddy.
So you disagree.
I thought that the description of an asshole that goes around specifically confusing little old ladies into selling him their valuables was the most accurate thing in the fucking book.
I was gonna say, like, I know at least three of those.
Yeah.
Personally, like, in town.
Yeah, we had one that was banned from every, like, good-natured shop because he was such an asshole for doing, like, specifically preying on people with early Alzheimer's. Like, that's not none of what... Oh, that makes me so mad. Did you pick that one because you knew it would make me so mad?
I picked it because it was one of only two opinions I could find.
The level of self-importance where you're going like, no, you don't understand. Provenance is made the fuck up. And, like, it's made the fuck up. Provenance, it happened to Christie's. Provenance is 90% who bought it from who. And if that sounds dumb to you, it's because it fucking is. It's like the provenance is stronger if it was purchased by someone you know the name of. Which doesn't actually make it real.
Sorry, I just have to skip ahead in my notes real quick.
That's not how provenance works. Like, it does. Provenance is fake and made up. Provenance is like a desperate justification for something that hasn't been tracked through history. I'm not saying that there is an alternative, because the problem with provenance is that it's genuinely very difficult without written record, which almost no one has. But the end result is that provenance is a series of fucking happenstance that you can link together to make it more or less likely that this is the truth about a piece. Like, certificates and signatures and documents are very few and far between.
Or, as Donna Tartt puts it, it was the secret no one told you, the thing you had to learn for yourself, that in the antiques trade there was really no such thing as a correct price. Objective value, list value, was meaningless. If a customer came in clueless with money in hand, as most of them did, it didn't matter what the books said, what the experts said, what similar items at Christie's had recently gone for. An object, any object, was worth whatever you could get somebody to pay for it.
That was the most accurate line in the entire book. That was the most, like, on the nose, like, clearly Donna Tartt went to a couple of auctions, because, yeah, it's all made up and the prices don't matter. Prices tend to be a rough number that everyone who cares agrees on. That doesn't mean it's rooted in any kind of objective reality. It's just what we all found at the same time that people were willing to hand over. Say, hey, what did you get for that? About $50, same. That's about what I guess we can get for this. It's not, there's no science to it. There's no, like, there's no actual formal agreement.
There's no secret cabal of antiques Illuminati.
Well, no, apparently our friends over at Shanana and would have you believe that...
S.J. Shrubsale.
Yeah, Mr. Shrubsale, who
went... Shrubsole, sorry.
Yeah, Mr. Shrubsole, who went, like, way out of his... at what I assume was his destiny of selling shrubs and decided to go do something else. Because nobody wants anyone to realize how easy it is to get tricked and played. And that, like, the entire industry is essentially a variation on themes of being played.
Now, counterpoint. Is his statement damage control to prevent people from assuming everything in his shop is fake?
Almost certainly, yeah.
Allegedly.
Yeah, what... No, I'm sure the stuff in his shop is real.
Yeah.
Because like I said, when I say provenance is a made up concept, I'm not saying that to say everything's fake and don't trust anyone. I'm saying that it's subjective as hell. Like there is so very little objective truth about anything. And that
outside of antiques even.
And that like that hey, by the way, hey, cool. That's a central theme in the book. I would say it's actually like a really heavy theme. That truth being what you can make of it from what you can perceive. But, like, yeah, I'm not saying that to disparage antiques or make everyone afraid that you're gonna get tricked constantly. It's just that, like, everyone is constantly misrepresenting how accurate any of this is to you. Like,
including us, apparently.
No, because, like, as when we tell you things, we're telling you kind of what we understand. Like, that's an aggregation of information. Like, if I tell you roughly what a price is, what I'm telling you is what everyone kind of realized we could get for a thing. No one is saying that there's no math problem that anyone did to get to that number. It's just, like, about what people think it's worth. And and knowing about what people think it's worth is how you keep yourself safe from getting tricked. And to state that it's very easy to trick people because there's no right answer, that's not wrong. That's 100% correct. And it's how people get tricked. And it happens so much more often at the higher levels, and nobody wants to talk about it. Especially not Christie's or Mr. Shrubsole.
So, the other antiques opinion I found on the internet...
Okay.
...was from ClintonHowellAntiques.com.
Now that one I recognize.
Really?
Yeah. Sorry, Mr. Shrubsole.
What is Clinton
Howell? Oh, I just know of it as, like, a high-profile sales group.
Oh, cool.
You see the name on Ruby Lane a lot.
Oh, there we go. To quote... The only rub that I have with the novel is, however, the choice of profession that her young hero ends up pursuing, which is as an antiques furniture dealer. Her descriptions of restoration, the trade, and even the furniture are trite.
Wow!
The business is both deeper, knowledge-wise, and shallower, size-wise, than she describes. I want to say that this is my bailiwick, but I know this is a novel, and it is a good one, and she has license.
I don't understand that.
He's an expert in the area, but he understands that it needs to be fictionalized in a fictional work to make it interesting.
Oh, okay. Because I don't disagree with what he said where, you know, it's deeper and smaller. That's right. But, like, I don't know how long he wanted us to be here talking about staining and wood matching. Like,
listen, I would be here for all of it.
I'm guessing when he says, like, the pool is smaller. I can't remember the exact wording, even though you literally just said it. I'm guessing he means that he had problems with the description. Like, there's that point where, like, the sales take place over the whole country. Like, because that was one of the points where the back of my head, I was like, nah, not really, though.
I don't know, because even here in Who the Fuck Cares, Massachusetts, we do get a lot of people coming through from all over the country and even other parts of the world to get our antiques.
That's true.
So I could assume that if you're going to New York City of all places for antiques, you would be willing to hike.
And when you're dealing with a high ticket, you're dealing with people who can afford to ship.
Yeah.
So.
He continues.
Oh. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
But the antiques industry is just so easily caricatured. It is a tedious punchline. T made a great what the fuck face and gesture.
Where is he going that people are talking about it at all?
Presumably antique store.
Like,
or antiques auctions or antiques. D, people do congregate in the antiques world outside of this podcast.
Yeah, no, I know that, but like they're not. Like, he's making it sound like, oh, he turned on the TV and he saw an arduous joke at the expense of the antiques industry. Like, what?
Perhaps he considers all of Antiques Roadshow to be an arduous joke at the expense of the antiques industry.
Wow, instead of, like, a carefully, like, assembled conglomeration of experts to help people, like...
That's just me ascribing my own very rude opinions to a third party in order to distance myself from backlash.
No, but please, what are his actual very rude opinions?
Her philosophical musings over the last 50 pages, whether it is to discuss the good that is engendered by evil or vice versa, or about art and from whence it comes, are sophomoric. They don't take away from the novel, but she certainly didn't want a happily ever after ending, and so she chose instead to wax lyrical. That said, I enjoyed it immensely.
I actually have to say I totally agree with that last part. Right? Yeah, yeah. That was spot the fuck on.
Not to spoil anything, but...
No spoilers, but... I mean, we are going to get into spoilers, though, aren't we?
We will. Right after I ask you the all-important question, does this book deserve a Pulitzer?
Yeah.
All right, we've decided.
I don't know, yeah, I'm gonna go with yeah. No, you know what? I'm actually gonna go with maybe. I'm gonna go with probably.
Okay, because it did win one.
Yeah.
Is the thing.
So what's your take? Do you think this book deserves a Pulitzer?
I didn't know it won a Pulitzer.
Is it on the cover?
Until like last month when I finally picked up a paperback copy and realized it said on the fucking cover. Yeah. By the way, Pulitzer. And apparently at the time in 2014 when it won the dang thing, it was a hotly debated topic in literary circles.
What, because it wasn't dry enough?
You might as well be writing for The New Yorker.
God, I fucking hate being right.
Because, if I may quote an extended passage from The New Yorker review...
Oh, hold on, wait, I'm gonna continue to try to predict, like, oh, all these people were having feelings and experiencing emotions, and it was just like, get on with it.
Oh, no. James Wood, reviewing the book for The New Yorker,
James Wood
said...
Not the actor.
James Wood.
Oh.
Wood singular. I kept on trying to imagine a different novel stripped of its unreasonable raison d'etre and its childish sweets. A more rigorous fiction entitled perhaps not The Goldfinch, but just Theo Decker. A novel with no stolen painting, no inexplicable theft, an unlikely explosion. No shootouts, no sudden deaths, and fatal abandonments. And fewer Dickensian or Nesbittian shops. Instead, there might have been the affecting story of, say, a 13-year-old boy, the victim of divorce, sent west from New York to the alien aridity of Las Vegas, forced to live with his unsuitable father. It was hard to imagine as the pages went by, but not impossible, because Las Vegas provokes the best sustained writing in this novel. When Theo's father watches football on television, and the afternoon light begins to thin, and Tart tenderly and evocatively paints this slight desolation of Sunday afternoons in the desert, does she have any idea of the very different writer she might still choose to become? Dee died halfway through me reading that.
Hey, Mr. Wood! Has anyone told you that you could just go write your own fucking book? It seems like you're just really busy jerking off about the book you could have been writing instead.
So, what James Wood is saying...
is that he's a piece of shit?
Is that this book does not deserve a Pulitzer because it was too interesting.
This book doesn't deserve a Pulitzer because it wasn't my book. My book would be so much better and it would be about a boy named Jim Wood. And it would be about divorce and how much I like Las Vegas.
Dee, you must admit, we do have a dire shortage of stories about 13-year-old boys whose lives are torn apart by divorce.
And who just have, like, crappy dads as a... this motherfucker...
I have never in my life seen another work of fiction about an adolescent boy who feels distanced from his father by divorce.
No, I would actually say there's maybe an arid desolation of books about that subject.
Won't someone think of the men?
No, could you imagine fucking writing down with your own fucking two hands, putting your those withered little stumps of flesh to keyboard and saying, this book was bad because it had too much, and then listing, like, a list of the most exciting and cool shit you could be reading about and going, like, and I didn't like it. I don't like explosions, or art,
also,
or auctions,
also,
or
I think...
antiques, or consequences, like, imagine.
I think part of the problem might be that James Wood is the most sheltered man on the face of the planet because he believes that terrorist attacks are, quote, unlikely.
In New York, really?
Yeah.
Mr. Wood, really? I don't want
Not to be a grim son of a bitch,
I don't
but...
want... Not to be gauche, Mr. Wood, but, like, I have bad news about the last 20 years. Wow, you're right. You know what? You're right.
D, when was the last time a shootout made the news?
Who the fuck? Can you imagine if there was a huge terrorist attack in New York? Now, nope. That would just be awful.
Who could possibly foresee?
You ever seen that joke where the person is commenting on a recipe and then they say, "This is a wonderful recipe. I changed," and then they list every
ingredient,
and then someone else comments like, "What you did is made an entirely different cake."
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
And listen, I can relate to reading a story and in your mind at the same time rewriting the story you wish it were in your head.
Well, usually you don't get paid by The New Yorker.
Or rather, I usually don't make it more boring when I do that.
Yeah.
I usually don't strip it of the cool shit.
Could you imagine, did he use the word trite? I feel like he said trite.
No, that was the other guy.
What if the goldfinch, he did say that the painting The Goldfinch shouldn't have been in the book The Goldfinch, which is like
correct.
A hell of a take.
Themes are for 8th grade book reports.
I'm gonna give him nightmares. I'm gonna focus so hard. I'm gonna become a believer in spreading energy, and I'm going to make myself sick in how hard I'm going to send that man bad vibes.
You're going to manufacture a tulpa out of all of your hatred for this man.
Yeah, and I'm gonna fucking throw it down the stairs. What the heck? It's, you know, you ever see people get mad about, like, oh, the judges on Chopped and how it's, like, not fair because they say, like, I don't think your dish was good because I don't like tomatoes. This is that. But on, like, on this, like ultra-high-profile scale. Like, they paid that man to say this garbage out of his human mouth. Oh, that makes me so mad. I don't even want to criticize. I have my own criticisms about the book, but, like, I don't even want to say them because now I just want to, like, cross my arms over my chest and be like, I like it when interesting things happen in a fascinating way to characters, and it's not just about a 13-year-old boy whose dad kind of sucks and they got divorced.
Do you want to hear more criticism of The Goldfinch?
What if this book whose central theme is grief didn't have any? What the? Yeah, I guess that would be a different book.
I think Moby Dick could be improved if you removed the whale, and man, also Ishmael never left shore.
Yeah, if he kept being a teacher.
What if A Tale of Two Cities just stayed in London? Like, why can't it be A Tale of One City?
Why does it have to be two cities? Well, that's so
surely one city would suffice.
That's so unlikely. Like, I'm sorry, a huge revolution in France?
Does this house really need 7 gables?
I don't think it needs 7 gables. Really? Who are you paying for your shingling?
Does the letter have to be scarlet? Surely black fabric would have been more prudent.
Garish. Who's gonna stitch a red letter onto themselves? It doesn't make sense. They didn't even do that in Puritan times.
Is Gatsby all that great? Let's be real.
Unrealistic that that island doesn't exist in New York.
Do we need both Romeo and Juliet?
No. What if Romeo and Juliet were just about a guy? Romeo, his parents have divorced.
And he has to move to Las Vegas.
And he has to move to Las Vegas. And he's just not happy about it.
And he gets sad when he watches his father on television.
Yeah, his dad watches television and he's like, this is probably a metaphor for something, but I don't want to dwell too much on metaphors because that would make this book boring.
So Douglas Perry in The Oregonian.
Dipshit. Oh my god. This is why I dropped out of English school. Like I was gonna go back to get my English degree. This is like almost like, this encapsulates the exact reason I didn't do it.
Quote, admit it. You didn't sip your tea, recross your legs, and luxuriate over the prose. You kept going, 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 as if someone were about to snatch the book from your hands, which someone probably was. Your spouse, or your best friend, or your office mate, whoever had claimed dibs on it when you were done.
So the book was bad because I was too invested in reading it?
The book is not art because it is compelling.
Can you imagine? This man said out loud, I know I've been saying this a lot, but like,
here's the thing. Not to be art school guy, but I went to art school, and the only consistent definition of art was, it makes you look at it.
it's compelling in a way.
Compulsion is the only...
It's the soul of art. It's the only reason that you don't throw out, like, Jackson Pollock. It's because whatever you feel about it, it's compelling.
It's making you feel something.
You're doing something. You're looking at it. Like, alright, fine. You know what? James Wood gets to live. This guy's gonna get... He's gonna get to be my new tulpa, because he actually went a step further and said, the book is bad because you enjoyed reading it.
Real talk. That is what most of the criticism boils down to.
I'm gonna throw up in my mouth. Why?
It is consistently called Dickensian.
You mean one of the greatest authors of all time?
Not finished. And Potter-esque.
Referring to?
Harry Potter.
Oh, You mean one of the most influential books of all time? Yes. Oh, okay.
Now, here's the thing. Dickens was paid by the word, and it shows. Dickens was never writing literature. His very late works approached something like theme, like beyond the kind of themes you find in an 8th grade book report, but he died before he finished it. So to call Donna Tartt Dickensian is to show how much you don't fucking know about Dickens.
Or I'm actually gonna hazard literature.
I mean, you know.
Like,
that said, The Goldfinch is, I would say, very nearly a modern retelling of Oliver Twist.
That scans, yeah.
Chopped up with David Copperfield. If only for sheer length.
Okay.
Pad
it out.
For sheer length and the insistence that an autobiography must cover the character's entire life.
Okay.
Now we come to Potter-esque.
That's a weird one. I actually wasn't expecting that.
I think what they all meant to imply, or rather what they overtly told me they meant to imply, is that it is Harry Potter for adults, that it is very childish and self-soothing writing.
Yeah. My favorite part of Harry Potter and the fake antique chair, which is a very, like, a forgotten side book, was definitely when it was an alternate retelling of him growing up, but he stayed in the cabinet and developed an interest in furniture.
My favorite part of Harry Potter was his crippling meth addiction.
Yeah, absolutely, the hardcore drug addiction. It was a weird choice for kids. See, I thought that they were actually just, like, actually one-to-one railing against the fact that the book was any fun.
Also that, yes.
And they were like, I don't think art should be fun.
Here's the thing. This is all, the people calling it Potter-esque are all widely regarded literary critics, people who have read a great deal, who know how to break a book down to its base components and see what is truly beneath it through all of the metaphor and the symbolism.
Yeah, they look at it and they say, well, is this about a 13-year-old boy with divorced parents in Las Vegas?
Characters in the book directly compare the protagonist to Harry Potter because they are all 13-year-olds who have read Harry Potter. Can you believe that these great literary minds at the New Yorker were able to pick up on these subtle parallels to Harry Potter within the novel, wherein the characters say, hey, you remind me of Harry Potter. I'm going to call you Potter out loud with my mouth every time we meet. That's going to be my consistent nickname for you. It's going to be a symbol of the depth of our friendship, is that I affectionately call you Potter because you wear glasses and you're an orphan.
I was really hoping you'd get it. I didn't bring it up because, like, oh, I know Ken's going to dig into that gem about how literally the character's pet name is Harry Potter.
It's just the subtlety.
It's so subtle.
You really have to go to New Yorker to get literary criticism of such depth.
Such as, she said the character was like Harry Potter, and I was like, meh.
I read the words Harry Potter in the book, and I think this might be linked to the book Harry Potter.
These people get paid to say this stuff.
They do. I mean, arguably, we get paid to say this stuff, but...
Like, yeah, but I mean, like, they get paid, like, handsomely.
Oh yeah, they can actually pay their rent. It's great.
Like their arguments might have actually swayed the Pulitzer decision. I'm glad it didn't, ultimately, because I assume whoever was on the Pulitzer team was just like, I don't think wanting to read the book is a detractor.
I mean, yeah. When you get down to brass fucking tacks, writing is communication. And part of communication is convincing your audience to continue listening to what you have to say.
Yeah.
Which is more difficult than you might think.
Have you ever listened to some, like just putting aside these like, self-inflated windbags for, like, a second. Have you ever met a person who was just like, couldn't get into the book, I couldn't put it down. It really annoyed me. I had to stop reading it because it was just too engrossing.
I couldn't enjoy it. I was having too much fun.
Lord.
I was just going to say, if you're going to compare Donna Tartt to any other author, I would compare her first and foremost to Patricia Highsmith.
That's fair.
In terms of both her role in the literary scene and the kinds of stories she tends to tell. And the sort of language she employs to do it.
That's fair. I like that. I like that comparison. I would also make the argument that Donna Tartt's kind of her own thing. So that thing you said earlier, where you were talking about Donna Tartt's novels very, very, very frequently focus on the after effects. It's always the consequence. And it actually does tend to kind of run directly to the consequence over a lot of inciting action. I think that's super unique. I don't think a lot of stories will actually say, like, here, how we got here isn't important. What's happening because of it is. And I think that that is actually very novel.
Novel, because it's a book.
Like, I think Donna Tartt is pioneering in that respect.
Yeah.
It's like a, like an Updike kind of thing. Except Updike's thing was kind of just like, I don't have to tell a story. This is my book.
So an hour in.
Oh, boy.
We finally come to the spoiler half of the podcast, where we are going to get specific. And if you want to be surprised by aspects of this book, you should stop listening and go read it. Hopefully we've said something that makes you want to.
I will spoil it by saying it absolutely is not about a 13-year-old boy in Las Vegas with a disappointing father.
It's part of it.
I mean, that's like a facet. Part of the story. Yeah.
So to me, the part of this book that stuck out the most, the part that stuck with me, and the part that made me continue reading it, and the part that really was the entire book for me, which is why I'm surprised it gets half a sentence in the blurb, is the antiques part.
Same, yeah. I thought that that was really moving.
Okay. So Theo. Theo's a fucking wreck.
Yeah, yeah, mess.
Theo's a human hot mess.
And, like, honestly, like, big mood.
Yeah, like, I can relate. And it's understandable that he's a hot mess, because his fucking mother died in a terrorist attack that he survived. His mother that he loved very dearly and who was very close to him when he was 13. So he's been a little traumatized and his psyche is a little frozen in amber as a result. And he has to deal daily with the crippling trauma, literally crippling.
Yeah, crippling in every sense of the word.
Psychologically crippling. That said, I know I say this about every piece of media I interact with, but the bulk of his problems could be solved if he would just be gay and do crime.
Yeah, I mean, can I underline the two biggest problems I had with the book?
Sure.
I'm actually going to skip over the last chunk because I think, like, universally everyone is like, that was a weird way to denouement. It kept wrapping around to this idea that Theo didn't actually love antiques, which is an interesting, like, it's an interesting fine point to put on something when you have managed to encapsulate every feeling I had ever had about antiques as, oh, this might surprise you, a hardcore antiques enthusiast.
I think he does genuinely love antiques, but the problem is that he is not just his mother's son, he is also his father's.
Well, it's the other problem is also that, like, you're right. I think the other issue I'm having is that maybe I'm not taking into account that the person who says this is Theo, who we're going to call him questionable in his self-assessment.
He is an unreliable narrator.
Because, like, I get the impression that maybe his statement about that is because he's got, like, a heapin' helpin' of imposter syndrome.
Imposter syndrome is when you think you're an imposter. He is an imposter.
Well, no, because he's not. Because
he is a textbook compulsive liar.
Compulsive liar,
he
yes.
He cannot tell the truth. He is physically and psychologically incapable of honesty.
But he's genuinely passionate.
Yes.
But there's that one moment where he describes himself as possessed by the... I can't remember the guy's name. Holy shit. The guy who died.
Welty?
Welty. Possessed by Welty. And that is why he... Like, he literally says that. And that's why he can do anything with furniture, which was, like, wild to me because, like, everything up till that point had described a character who is passionate about it. Even if eventually he turns into a lying liar who lies, even if the passion for tricking people supersedes his passion for antiques and furniture, it's still a passion, but it, like, kind of, it felt a little bit like it was trying to go back and go, like, and now he never felt anything for it at all. Which
kind
I
of like how he backpedals on his feelings for Boris.
That was my second problem, is, like, that was a really heavy emotional moment, and then it went nowhere. And, like, we just never looked at it again. This isn't even necessarily, like, straight up me on author. It's entirely possible that I was meant to be feeling all of these things because it's a first-person narrative. You know, take that as you will. Maybe there's a good reason why the whole thread where he's in love with Boris gets dropped.
I don't think it does.
No?
No. Because I compiled a sub-document in my notes titled Internalized Homophobia.
That's fair.
Which Theo has in spades. oh my God, is this guy dripping with internalized homophobia? And it's very, I won't say easy, because it's not easy to trace any single narrative in Theo's life, because he, one, is a lying liar who lies, and two, because Donna Tartt's signature style is jumping back and forth through time to reveal certain bits of the information to the reader at certain moments. But considering the deeply yet subtly homophobic environment he grew up in, it is not surprising that he would be so stringent in denying his feelings for another man.
Even so, you're having it in you.
There is, very late in the novel, but very early in his life, the incident where he is, trigger warning for sexual assault for the next 30 to 60 seconds, where he is attacked in the showers at school by two other boys where they try to shove a deodorant stick up his anus.
Yes.
So I would argue that might make one a little shy. All yes. Around other dudes in sexual situations.
I would say so, yes.
And then the continued homophobic bullying that any male American teenager will go through, just being and existing at age 13 in America.
Yeah.
And I think it's to be noted that when he moves to Las Vegas, he keeps up communications with Hobie until Boris refers to Hobie as an old poofter.
Yeah.
Which is, not unaffectionately, Boris himself does not seem to have any real problem with gay people. He employs, like, arguably irreverent slang when discussing them, but he doesn't seem to have any real, no malice, no hostility. It's just like, yes, gay people exist, I acknowledge their existence, and I'm fine with it.
Well, because he follows up that statement with what a nice person Hobie seems like.
Yeah, exactly.
Like,
his attitude toward gay people is always like, yeah, they're there. Keep on keeping on.
Sure.
Keep on trucking.
Not much gets to Boris.
Reach for the stars. Live your bliss. Chase your dreams. But yeah, but when Boris refers to Hobie as an old poofter, affectionately even, but as a gay person, Theo, for the first time, considers that this antiques bachelor might be gay, which is amazing. And
whose partner's signet ring he returned to him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Your business partners. Speaking of business partners, not only does Theo drop contact with Hobie when he realizes he might be gay, but two, when Theo becomes Hobie's business partner, there's a particular scene in his re-meeting with Boris, where Boris is like, your partner seems like a cool guy, and Theo is immediately like, we're not partners, I'm not gay, it's not like that, I'm straight, and Boris is like, dude! Can you chill?
I've met a business partner before, my
yeah,
dude.
Yeah, no, I just said the word partner. I thought you guys were business partners because you work in his antique store. Like, can you chill for a minute? And then the conversation goes on for a bit. And then Boris is like, so your boss? And Theo is immediately like, he's not my boss. I'm his business partner. Because Theo has many things, but he does not have an inkling of self-awareness.
Not even an ounce. I'm guessing that that's also probably why the fact that Hobie is most likely gay and the partner of Welty, it's not a thing that anyone talks about. It is hinted at very obliquely, like maybe once or twice. I think like a couple of times Theo's just like, I don't really know what's going on with Hobie. And that's it.
There is one girl where Theo's like, is he just hanging out with this married woman, or are they dating, or are they friends? What's going on?
Yeah, yeah.
Because Theo has a lot of difficulty with romance as a concept in general.
Yeah, I think that is why that doesn't get touched on, is because it's being filtered through Theo. So, like, if Theo has all these blocks, why on earth is he also going to be like, I'm pretty sure Hobie's gay? Like, it's obviously not a subject he wants to touch.
No. So Theo has a lot of justifiable internalized homophobia. Like, it's ruining his life, arguably, but it's understandable where it came from.
Yeah.
But again, he would be so much happier if he would just be gay to Christ.
Yeah, yeah. It's one of those things where, like, I think it becomes most obvious when he meets his fiance. Because, like, the hammer keeps falling down on, like, he likes her. He thinks she's a great person. He enjoys the time he spends with her. He has no romantic feelings for her.
Well, it's also, he is fixated on Pippa in a way that he personally interprets as romance. But if you're not actually Theo, and you are in fact a person reading him lying to himself for 800 pages, you very clearly see that, oh, because of the intense trauma he endured at age 13, he hyper-fixated on a particular detail of the explosion, which happened to be a living human being who happened to be a girl his own age, and therefore he believes that he is in love with her.
Yeah.
And not merely obsessed with her.
Which the book did a nice, I thought it did a good job of deconstructing it.
And Theo himself is almost aware of this.
He gets there, like, and there is, like, I'm pretty sure it's near the end where Pippa writes him a letter and says, "This is trauma bonding. Let's not."
She says it very sweetly.
Well, yes, yes. It's a like, hey, can we work on this and still be friends, but, like, throw that rest of it in the garbage. You know, like, they do have a whole discussion about how their friendship is good for both of them and horribly terrible for both of them at the same time, which is like,
because there's really no one else they can relate to because they are the two kids of the same age who survived the explosion and each lost a parental figure and who were forever changed by it. But also, by continuing to communicate with each other, they are fixating on their trauma rather than moving past it.
Which, hey, does that sound an awful lot like a theme? A theme that might be related to the idea that, like, there is no black and white for things that are good and bad, and that sometimes they bleed into each other? Seems like it to me.
I just don't see why the story had to have an explosion, or really any characters besides Theo and his dad.
I don't really get it.
Or, like, why there had to be, like, any death, like instead of, like, just divorce.
City other than Las Vegas. Seems extraneous.
Or as, the way Theo approaches Pippa is, like, classic Reddit night sky, but, like, the upscale version of that.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's because he keeps describing her in a way that, while obviously filtered through his own lens of obsession, like, does give the audience a picture of a very sweet young woman who is quirky and fun and a well-rounded person with, like, hopes and dreams and, like, a full emotional range that does not happen to extend quite as far to him as he would like.
Yeah.
But he keeps going on about how, like, she's not, like, classically beautiful, but she's beautiful to me. It's just, like, every time you describe her, like, yeah, she's a cute redhead with freckles. Like, she's not a troll, my dude. And even if she was, as Tumblr user well and truly put it, Theo, a disturbing obsessive, genuinely thought he was going to "You Don't Know You're Beautiful" Pippa. You have to laugh. Because he keeps going on about how her boyfriend doesn't deserve her, and how he makes so much more money than her boyfriend. And he thinks this to himself as he is actively cutting up lines of OxyContin with his Christie's card.
God to live that life, though.
He's just like, unironically thinking to himself, why can't I buy the human object of my obsession? No one else could possibly appreciate her like I do. And it's just like, I feel like she is more appreciated by the man who lets her be something other than his own trauma.
I like this. I like the slow slide where he's like, no one understands her like I do. But then as, like, the haze of drugs wears off,
he realizes.
He's like, I haven't spent that much time with Pippa, actually.
I don't understand her, actually.
I like, barely know her.
I'm almost aware of this. Almost. And it's funny how he thinks that his love of antiques comes from being possessed by Welty, who was the guardian of Pippa and her uncle and who loved her very much. So why does he not then conclude that perhaps his obsession with Pippa is also the ghost of Welty?
Yeah, and was actually like a platonic thing.
Like, yeah, like a platonic parental caretaking thing, perhaps.
Which, like, it's still unhinged, but it's like a better version.
And then there's also, if I may, just one...
Listen, this whole episode is so you may.
One particularly relatable passage on going to Tiffany's. New, charmless, dead in hand, $800 for a made yesterday plate. One plate. There were beautiful 18th century sets to be had for a fraction of the price of this cold, bright, newly minted stuff.
Oh my god, that was absolutely, I think, bar none my favorite passage. As someone who has actively been to a Tiffany's. Accurate, yeah. Being in a Tiffany's is like this weird, terrifying experience.
But how's the breakfast?
You know, I never make it all the way through. That's a joke about the movie because I've never finished it.
To continue. It made me think of the nice old Marimekko-clad ladies I sometimes went to see in the Ritz Tower. Gravel-voiced, turban-wearing, panther-braceleted widows, looking to move to Miami, their apartments filled with smoked glass and chrome steel furniture that, in the 70s, they'd purchased through their decorators for the price of good Queen Anne. But, I was responsible for telling them, reluctantly, had not held its value and could not be resold at even half of what they'd bought it for.
Yeah.
If you're new to this podcast, I'm the one that hates mid-century modern.
That's him. I would take up that a lot of mid-century modern is worth a lot now.
Yeah, I was gonna say that is the number one thing people kept asking after in the shop.
Well, like, and there's a lot of high-profile names and brands that held their value extraordinarily well, but...
But Theo lives in the 19th century, much like myself, so...
Well, I mean, you know.
You know.
Guessing you spend all the time researching Applewhite, you don't suddenly go like, and I think that mid-century modern is good too.
So now that we're in spoiler territory, we are freed up to talk about art fraud.
Oh boy, there's so much of it in this book.
Antiques fraud.
Yeah, it was hard to read.
Really?
Just because I like Hobie, the character Hobie.
The character of Hobie is beautiful and perfect and I love him.
Yeah, and what happened to him hurts. And I get that's entirely the point.
So what happens to Hobie is that he is good and pure and a bastion of delight. And he is passionate about antiques and antiques repair and restoration. And truly an expert who does in-text work for Sotheby's and Christie's restoring furniture. And in his spare time cobbles together the truly broken beyond repair bits into new pieces of furniture. That, if you don't know too much about antiques, could pass for example, Heppelwhite. Theo takes advantage of this by, behind Hobie's back, selling all of these chameleon pieces as genuine articles. Because yeah. Theo is a fucking monster.
Yeah.
How the fuck? If there is a Hobie in your life, how do you even justify that level of betrayal?
I don't understand how, because, like, you... I think I went in this tear before where, on a personal, emotional level, the idea that you would be handed a ticket to the absolute upper echelons of antiquary...
The fucking Willy Wonka of antiques. Like, you have the golden ticket. Yeah, you're inheriting the fucking factory.
You got Oliver Twisted into the fucking dream. And then you go and you act like a fucking bastard about it?
Theo even points out that he's only able to get away with this because Hobart and Blackwell, the antique store that Welty Eustone and Hobie currently owns, has built up a reputation over decades for reliability.
Reliability.
Faithfulness. Trustworthiness. Like, decades, Hobie and Welty worked to make sure that they were always correct, always upfront, always being true to the customer, true to the piece, and never once overselling on anything.
And that, speaking as someone who worked in an establishment that had that kind of stellar reputation, is a hard-won victory. It takes decades to get people to believe in you like that.
And one coked-up jackass to ruin it.
One coked-up jackass that you took in at your own expense, in every sense of the word expense.
One coked-up jackass that you took in as an orphan, over the objections of your friends.
And that boy's legal counsel.
That you raised up as your own and taught the trade that you hold so dear to your heart, so faithfully. And he do you like this.
And he do you like this? Like this you do him? Theo?
A lot of the critics were complaining that Hobie was too likable to the point of being fanciful. Like, no human being could possibly exist like this.
What a sad thought. What a sad life they must live.
Again, like, wow, I'm so sorry for your life where you had nothing but Las Vegas and your father watching television.
Yes, sorry for your loss,
I guess. I'm sorry your life had no truly good people in it. Like, I will admit they are rare birds, but they do exist.
I've had friends.
I have loved them very dearly. Like,
yeah, like, no, it's that weird, this, like, sorry for the sidebar again. It's that weird thing where, like, right now and for the last, like, 50 years, like, the entire literary industry, like, thrives on this fucking, like, smug, self-satisfied cynicism.
It has to be miserable and boring, otherwise it's not real art.
Like, the minute you indulge in, even if you came up with a pure fantasy, like, I'm gonna keep bringing up Oliver Twist because it's a great example. Like, if you put your toe there, everyone immediately dismisses it as like, well, I don't know, you looked like you smiled for a second there, so... I hate it. I absolutely hate that that's, like, the industry standard, is if it's not 100% unmitigated misery, it's, like, it's unrealistic, and fuck you.
10 points from Hufflepuff.
Yeah, like...
Also, I would argue that by making Hobie such a bastion of goodness and purity, it makes that betrayal hit home that much harder for the reader, because yeah. I feel like everyone, most people with, like, empathy and, like, hearts, fell in love with Hobie. And then to have him betrayed so thoroughly and so deeply by the boy he did everything for and asked nothing in return from, fuck you, Theo.
Yeah, Theo.
Theo.
You did this.
Here's the thing. Deeply traumatized. I get it. Pippa was in the exact same explosion, also lost her parent, also lost the ability to do music, the one thing she was truly passionate about in this world, and she didn't betray Hobie.
No.
She actually...
Theo!
...managed to fucking...
It's a call-out post for this character!
She managed to survive that and not stab Hobie in the back to his very soul.
Yeah, which, by the way, reviewers over at the New York Times, I know that maybe they don't like...
The New York Times liked it. The New Yorker was fine with it. The New Yorker was less chill.
Like, I know that maybe they don't pay for you to go to, like, workshops or whatever, but we call that character foil in the biz. And it's just, like, this little thing. I guess it's kind of juvenile to, like, contrast characters and their habits to, I don't know...
To emphasize certain points and themes.
And understandings of relationships. I get, you're right. Maybe that's a little amateurish. Dickheads. Yeah, Hobie's a character foil for Theo. I think it also, like you said, it kind of... I love Hobie. I think it does kind of underline that, like, I think by the end of it, you're supposed to get to the point where you are understanding that however tragic Theo's circumstances have been, he's making a lot of choices to stay in that bubble of misery.
Correct.
Because you do have Hobie and Pippa, who have been through much of the same trauma, and have emerged to the other side of it.
Arguably Boris.
Boris, absolutely. Although,
do not get me wrong, makes a titanic asshole.
He's a major fuck
up. But he manages to do it without maliciousness, which I'm going to say Theo lacks.
Yeah, that's the thing. Is like when you scan Boris's character, it genuinely feels like he never conceived of an alternative, and he doesn't do it because he enjoys hurting people. And Theo says pretty much out his own damn mouth, he does what he does because he enjoys hurting people. He says himself, like, he gets high off of the feeling of superiority. And that's why he tricks people.
He genuinely loves tricking the people who come into the shop.
Yeah, he likes it. He does it on purpose.
He gets off on this. He is his father's son as well as his mother's.
Yeah. Like, Boris as much... Like, and they even underline that because Theo has a moment where he understands... Like, he has that bonding moment where he's like, oh, I get why my dad's just a fucking colossal dickhead. Like, obviously... And, like, with Boris, it's obviously that's not an excuse for the things he does.
No.
But, like you said, there's a lack of maliciousness that lets you understand that, like, no, I don't think there was ever another life for him.
Returning to the subject of Boris.
Yeah.
I love him.
I know we want to stay there, because Boris is an excellent character.
Boris is delightful. Never want to meet him in person. Absolutely delightful.
No, would shoot me 100% in the dome, yeah.
He wouldn't shoot you. He only kills in self-defense. It's not murder. He's explained this.
Oh, Boris.
Fucking Boris.
Well, Boris, like, Boris is my favorite count, like, almost ironic to the way many reviewers would view the book, an excellent counterpoint to that kind of, like, aimless cynicism. Boris is the absolute under, like, he is the exclamation, the interrobang on the end that, like, even when shit sucks, it doesn't have to be pure fucking misery. That, like, there are all these, like, choices you could be making. Which, like, again, leads into the idea where you realize slowly that Theo's been making these choices.
Like the choice to not examine his internalized homophobia, which could maybe lead to him living a more fulfilling and less hollow life.
Listen, it works.
Also...
It just works.
So, ultimately, Theo believes he has to choose between two women. Pippa, who... has rejected his advances over and over and over again and is tolerating his obsessive, creepy, stalkerish behavior out of respect for their friendship. And Kitsy, who is marrying him to appease the mother who is so traumatized by the death of her son, who happened to be Theo's best friend, that she has glommed onto Theo as the only living memory of her son.
Real talk, I love Kitsy. I think she's a fabulous character.
Kitsy's great. However, Theo's treatment of her is horrendous.
It's awful.
How he constantly tells the reader that everything's fine, everything's great, this marriage is great, fantastic, wonderful. I can only stand to be around my fiancé and her friends if I am coked to the gills. Without a trace of irony. I mean, Donna Tartt is being ironic. Theo is not being ironic.
Yeah. Well, I did like the part. Theo does express actual, genuine enjoyment of her. Like, as a person. He does actually seem to understand and love her in a way.
He understands objectively that she is a good option. He does not truly feel anything for her.
I think he feels friendship for her.
I don't think it's even that.
I would argue that it is. I think that he got caught up in the fact that they genuinely enjoyed spending time with each other, and he goes, there it is. That's the big thing, right? I found it. I don't hate her stupid guts. I'm straight now. Like, I would definitely put my ball, because he doesn't like her lifestyle or her friends, which granted is toxic as hell. But like, he mentions that he really likes spending time when it's just the two of them. So, like, I do think that they're genuinely compatible people. And I think even Kitsy says, like, you're a less miserable asshole when we're together. It works. We're friends. Kitsy herself just says, like, no, we're good friends, and I'm marrying you because this will be convenient. But, like, I do genuinely believe that, I believe there's the seed of friendship there. I think Theo rejects it.
Well, there's also coming back to making life decisions based on trauma.
Yeah.
Where Kitsy is marrying Theo because of the trauma of the death of her brother, and marrying Theo keeps Theo in the family, which keeps the ghost of Andy alive in their family.
Yeah.
Which is just like, hey, it's almost as though trauma regarding the death of family members is a theme in this book.
Now, Ken, themes are for 8th grade book reports.
We don't need any death in this book. We just need a divorce and a move to Vegas.
What if he just got divorced and went to Vegas? Now, hear me out. I want to follow up. Yeah, and where does the plot go from there, sir?
We don't need plot.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Plot is for 8th grade.
Plot is for 9th grade booker. For people who enjoy harried Potters.
But it even comes down to Hobie, who, like, in his final scene with Theo, reveals that he got into antiques as a direct result of the death of his mother.
Yeah, it's all about grief.
The reason Pippa even lives with Welty in the first place is because of the death of her mother.
Yeah, but there's like a counterpoint, right? It's like Kitsy, he fostered a true love, a bright spot out of something horrifying.
Kitsy is marrying Theo to appease the ghost of her mother because her mother is a shell of a hollow human after the death of her husband and son.
Yeah, counterpoints. It's all counterpoints.
But why do we need death in this book?
I don't really think we need it. What if Welty had just divorced his mother?
Fuck, okay. No, but like...
Lord almighty. No, I think that those comparisons are the kind of vibrant character building that make the book very compelling.
But returning to Theo and his false dichotomy, mm-hmm. born of internalized homophobia.
Yes.
He believes he has to choose between a woman he is so obsessed with he thinks he's in love with her, or a woman he understands is objectively a good option, but he feels no real affection for, mm-hmm. rather than the man that he's already had sex with, who's kissed on the mouth, who is only prevented by his own internalized homophobia from telling him he straight up loves him.
No, he says it to himself once.
He says it to
and
himself.
And notably, the only character he ever says that about, including
Pippa. Yeah.
Like, he never says
never says I love you to Hobie, never says I love you to Pippa, never says it to Kitsy. He says it to Boris.
And in
his own mind, but it is one of his great regrets, and believe me, Theo has a lot of regrets, but one of his greatest regrets is not saying I love you out loud to Boris. Also, the combination lock he uses for the stolen painting that is the entire reason this book exists.
In the center of his life.
The combination to get to that painting is Boris's phone number. Not Pippa's. So not Hobie's. Not Welty's. Not his mother's. Not his father's. Not anyone else's. Boris's phone number.
Yeah.
Is the key to what is arguably his heart.
Yeah, yeah.
The only reason this book does not end with Boris and Theo going off into the sunset together to do art crimes hand in hand is because Donna Tartt is aware that she is writing literary fiction, and you cannot have a literary fiction book end in a happily ever after.
Because of what we said earlier about the smug sense of cynicism.
Yes.
Yeah, no, I 100% agree, especially because the end beats, like, the big broad beats of the end, which Boris does actually, I liked it when Boris said it. I like the part where Boris says everything has to be black and white for you, and when it doesn't fit there, you just self-destruct.
Because Boris says a lot of things, but you cannot argue he does not have insight.
Yeah, that's the thing. And so you could argue that Boris's tendency towards the seedier aspects of life, combined with his lack of overt malice, actually is an excellent blend for Theo, who is making the choice to not divorce the bad things he does from the pleasure he derives from them. So what you're telling me is that the character that he is admittedly the only one Theo's ever said he loved is also saying, listen, things don't have to just be one way or the other all the time. Like, sometimes good things come from bad things.
Sometimes you don't have to like just girls or just boys. Sometimes you can like people regardless of gender. Sometimes you can... I feel like there might be a word for this, but I don't know. I'm doing too much heroin to figure it out right now.
I'm doing way too much heroin.
But I'm just saying, like, things don't always have to be, like, one or the other. Sometimes there can be, like, a spectrum of things you can choose from.
Yeah, like a whole...
Like, for some... Like, some concepts might not fall neatly into black or white, but perhaps on a sort of colored spectrum. Like a rainbow spectrum?
Maybe even.
Maybe. Like, you could do more than, like, one thing or the other thing. Like, you could do both things. You could do many things. You could do, like, a whole lot of different things. Specifically with dudes and their mouths.
But, like, even practically, like, I appreciate that, and it's 100% correct. Even just practically speaking... Even just practically speaking, like, the space Boris occupies in the world is arguably the one Theo belongs in.
He's demimonde, the space between,
yeah,
the undercity.
Like, Theo himself is too toxic to be in Hobie's world.
Correct.
Like he's much too much of an actual predator. But there is, like, a seed of him that doesn't want to be a predator. He understands that what he's doing is bad and that he shouldn't want that life. But he also says that he's never going to be able to do anything but it. And we have here Boris, a character who represents striving for goodness while embracing the darker side of his nature. Amazing. These kids just can't work it out, huh? These crazy kids.
The reason this book descends into sophomoric philosophy 101 for the final 50 pages is because Donna Tartt is talking to herself on the page, trying to write her way out of the happy ending that is the obvious thematic conclusion for all involved.
Because Donna Tartt is a coward, you heard it here first.
It's not that she's a coward, it's that she is not a genre fiction writer. She is not writing fantasy, she is not writing romance, she is not writing alternative historical fiction, she's not doing any of that. She's writing literary fiction, which is a genre, and like any genre, it has rules it must follow to fall into that category, and one of the utmost rules of literary fiction is that it cannot end happily.
Counterpoint.
It cannot.
Counterpoint. Total fucking bullshit, and we should get rid of that stupid fucking rule.
I agree, but until we do... Donna Tartt cannot write happy endings.
Because I love literary fiction, but I am tired of being bummed out.
Come to romance.
Well, I already did.
We have chocolate.
I leaned down onto the grass and rolled right down into that hill.
People be like, why did LGBT people like romance so much? And it's just like, it's the only genre where we don't die at the end.
Like, it's just, like, I'm so...
Amazing.
I'm so tired. Like, a lifetime... albeit so far, pretty, like, you know, I'm 30, I'm still young, but, like, a lifetime of ingesting all of this fucking, like, smug cynicism where it's like, yeah, stuff's bad, take a drag of the cigarette and it'll just get worse, and it's like, fuck off, I'm done with it, I'm tired of it.
Like, what if we had hope for our future instead? Can you imagine?
Which is especially wild because, like, the theme of The Goldfinch is that good and bad things coexist as part of a rich tapestry of life.
Yeah.
And that, like, they cannot be separated into one or the other. So, like, bold move to be like, nah, but I can't give it a happy ending.
Literary fiction, man. It is the genre that refuses to admit it's a genre.
I will throw it all down the stairs.
Let's go.
Get ready for my biggest tulpa yet, the literary fiction industry.
Lit Fic, we're coming for you. You heard it here first. This podcast is going to take down literary
fiction. We're coming for it. Overall, I found it to be extremely moving. I did run into this book at the unenviable period of time where I had just lost my job dedicated to antiques. So it hit, like, 14 iron punches to the gut.
We should clarify, you were not fired. The shop closed.
Yeah, no, I was not fired.
This is not a firing, this is a layoff.
I am still considered, I am still in good with all of the other people in the local industry.
Until they listen to this podcast.
I don't know anyone. Well, I know a couple of people that high up, but they don't listen to things. Except you, Adam Lambert.
We know several people except in the local antiques industry who do listen to this podcast. I know. At least, and we value each and every one of them.
Hi, Jeff. Hi, Jeff. Adam Lambert, like, hello, Diane. I don't know if you're listening, but you glam on. You glam is on.
Oh, man. So, okay. We've been screaming for an hour and a half. My neighbors are thoroughly annoyed. Do we have any further thoughts, opinions, things we desperately want to get across about this book?
No, just that I thought the antiques bits, like I said before, they resonated very well. And that's speaking from someone who's like a total freak about this, an antiques freak, you might say. I really, really enjoyed it. It carried me through, even though sometimes the book was a bit much for me. Which isn't a detractor from it at all. That's just because I am fragile. And if anything, I would call that a bonus because things that can make you feel feelings is good.
Both good feelings and bad feelings. Yeah. Together. Not black or white.
Huh. Someone wrote a book about that.
Yeah.
How about you? What's your parting shots here?
So the movie. It's going to be a movie. I haven't seen any trailers. I know that the Stranger Things kid is in it. That's the bulk of what I know.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
And I did see the trailer.
Okay. You didn't see him in the trailer.
I am almost pathologically face blind.
Okay. So how do you think this is going to pan out? Because we've got like 3 weeks from when this episode drops to when the movie comes out.
Okay. I actually, rough take, I think it's going to pan out better than you think.
How did you already know I was cynical?
Well, because I know you. We've been friends for a while now. I think better than you think, but worse than you hope.
Okay, because what I have read of it so far seems like it's going to be at best a Vanity Fair situation. Which is to say they are going to take a novel that does not have a hero, it may have a protagonist, but doesn't have a hero, and they are going to turn the protagonist into a hero.
That I can definitely see happening.
Because the summary for the movie says a lot about love and redemption through love, which if they make him and Pippa end up together at the end, I am going to flip my entire body over the back of my theater seat and roll on the floor screaming amidst the popcorn and spilled soda.
So quick story, this will relate, I swear to God.
Uh-huh.
After I saw Mad Max Fury Road for the third time,
uh-huh,
I got so hepped up about it. I did legitimately chase down a man's pickup truck and jump in the back, screaming something unintelligible about, like, dying historic on the Fury Road. And while that wasn't a negative response, well, he certainly didn't feel as good about it as I did. I am going to say if they hook up Theo and Pippa, I will do something similar in terms of extremity of reaction.
So what you're saying is I should bring sedatives to the theater when we go.
Yeah, what I'm saying is that I might, like, I can't make any promises.
So the other way the redemption through love thing can pan out is if they do what Donatar could not, because they're movie makers and not litfic writers, and they have Boris and Theo go off together to do gay art crimes into the sunset.
Which I would say, actually, right now, the atmosphere for theater's never been better. We've had major hits like Carol and Moonlight, which have all explored heavy subject matters that involve LGBT relationships.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say that overall, that would be an excellent move. It'd be following in some great footsteps.
But when has Hollywood ever made an excellent move?
Well, never. Well, I mean, they made Moonlight, actually. That was a good movie.
So you understand my trepidation.
Yes, 100%.
You understand why I am refusing to allow my heart to build a cage for the thing with feathers.
Wow, okay. I think you need to read something a little less intense for a bit.
Such as a biography of the man who built Cragside?
Yeah, there you go.
Okay.
But yeah, no, I totally understand. Like I said, I firmly believe better than I think, but not as good as I hope.
Okay.
I think it'll probably be more, I think it'll probably be more, it's definitely, of course, going to stick to the fun stuff. I use fun very loosely here.
Compelling stuff, perhaps?
Compelling stuff. I think, actually, we're not going to get a whole lot of time with his dad in Las Vegas, much to James Wood's great chagrin.
It's just, I keep coming back to the, it's bad because it's compelling, it's not art because it forces you to look at it. And I just remember our art professor, dear sweet Bruce, who, much like Julian in The Secret History, but like a not evil version of Julian in The Secret History, explained to us that beauty is what makes you gawk.
I remember that. Yeah.
Like,
wow, you got it word for word.
Yeah. You know why? Because it struck a fucking chord, D. Because I've never fucking forgotten that lecture because he's correct. Art is what compels you to witness it.
Yeah, like, here's the thing. We're not making a podcast episode about the House of the Seven Gables for, like, I'm going to call it one very good reason. It's because neither of us fucking care.
I would say it's seven very good reasons.
One for each gable. One for each fucking gable. But I actually, listen, the house itself is remarkable.
It's a beautiful house. He should have written a better book about it.
Okay, well, the book could have lasted 5 minutes where he goes, that's a hell of a house. Wish I had it. And then he locks away. Because that's about my ability to engage with that house.
But it made you look at it.
But it made me look at it. I guess you're right. But yeah, it is much like that. I am saddened. I can feel in my bones that they are going to cut as much antiques from the story as they can.
That was the other thing, because so much of the antiques industry at your shop in particular, and even the one I worked at, was people who work for movie studios coming through to either rent or purchase set pieces and props.
Yeah.
And I haven't heard anything about them sourcing antiques for this film.
I haven't either, which is surprising, because if they want the kind of antiques that they are representing, it would be pretty high profile.
Yes.
No, it's, I don't know, I guess I'm curious to see how much antiques they'll leave in and how they're gonna tackle the fraud angle. And like you said, I'm curious as to what they have on deck for antiques. Did they have people constructing replicas? That's kind of fascinating from a thematic point of view.
We made fakes for this movie about fakes.
Yeah, like, I'm almost kind of hoping that's what it is. I don't know. It, like, I guess my little antiques loving heart wants to know how deep we're going to get into it, given that it's such a core part of the book. But, like, I know how the general public feels about antiques, and it's, well, generally not thinking about it hard enough to even caricaturize it much. I don't understand where that guy is getting that idea.
I think it says something that, like, antiques was so underplayed on the back of the book. Antiques is so lacking in the reviews. Like, even the antiques industry didn't notice this book about antiques.
Yeah, yeah.
So...
which was a disappointment. I really did want to see more people engaging with it.
Well, maybe now that we have made this podcast and released it into the world, and maybe someone has listened past the first 10 minutes of screaming to get to the actual content, maybe they will tell us what they thought of the book.
I would love to know. Honestly, like, I am dying to engage with people about this book.
Talk about this book with us, please.
Although I understand if you started listening to this podcast and you said, what... it's not about a kid whose dad is divorced and he went to Las Vegas. Dumb story! And then you, like, I guess that is valid, too.
Too much plot for me. Goodbye.
Oh, boy.
Are we ready for sources?
It's ready for sources.
Okay.
Is it? Wait. I want to guess one.
Okay.
The Goldfinch by Jonathan Hart?
You did! You guessed it. You was right. Sources for this episode include The Goldfinch by Jonathan Hart. Read it, won't you? Thank you. Other sources include NewYorker.com, The New Curiosity Shop, Donna Tartt's The Goldfinch. OregonLive.com, Why the Backlash Against Donna Tartt's The Goldfinch Was So Extreme. ClintonHowellAntiques.com, The Goldfinch As I See It. ShrubSoul.com, An Elegant Weasel, Donna Tartt's The Goldfinch.
I'm gonna throw him out of a window.
VanityFair.com, It's Tart, But Is It Art? TVTropes.org, Wikipedia, Edom Online, and yes, The Goldfinch.
Fantastic.
If you would like to yell at us about The Goldfinch, and please, please do, you can contact us directly at antiquesfreakspodcast@gmail.com. You can check out our Facebook page at facebook.com/antiquesfreaks. Join our Facebook group, Antiques Freaks Friends. If you would like to purchase some definitely not fraudulent vintage goods from us, we have an Etsy shop at etsy.com/shop/antiquesfreaks.
Promise.
Definitely no lies. And if you would like to listen to deleted scenes, you can check out our Patreon at patreon.com/antiquesfreaks. And you can also join the Random Vintage Postcard of the Month Club, where we send you a random vintage postcard every month.
And it's not fraudulent.
Not even remotely fraudulent.
If you like what your ears have heard this day, and you think more ears should be exposed to the shrieking, Please consider getting on down to wherever you're listening to this and shooting us a review. I would prefer a 5-star review for being completely transparent.
I'm not really bothered about the number of stars. Do what feels right to you.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, at the end of the day, you just let us know what you think. Do you think that our podcast should have more divorced dads in Las Vegas? Do you think we should be less interesting in general? Just let us know. It's a monstrous help. It's the metric by which all podcasts are measured, and it helps get us in other people's ears.
If you have some sort of deep moral objection to leaving a review on the internet, consider telling a real-life friend.
Yeah, that's fine, too. Hey, whatever. Everything works. If you believe in psychic phenomena, think really hard about a bunch of people listening to our podcast. Hey, whatever works.
I think that might be less helpful than the two prior methods, but by all means, give it a try.
Hey, chase your bliss.
Special shout out to our current patrons for paying our hosting fees and getting us ever closer to our goal of releasing bonus episodes. Yes, even more shrieking is possible through you. And thank you, dear listener, for listening.
Especially you.
Goodbye.
Bye.